The Greek philosopher Socrates once said that an unexamined life is not worth living. And I would suggest to you that an unexamined faith is not worth believing. We're in a series of sermons looking at the world religions, and these messages are significantly different than what we normally do. Normally we open the Bible and take a passage of Scripture and look at it, but because of all that's going on in the world, it's important for us to ask and answer the question, what does everybody believe? We've been led to believe in the United States over the years that everybody basically believes about the same thing with just little variations of it. But the question is that true? And last week we looked at Islam, and this week we're going to look at Hinduism. And I want you to see the chart on the world religions. We'll put it up here for you. About 30% of the world's population, it's actually a little bit more than that, would claim Christianity as their religion. About 20% would claim Islam. And about 14% would claim Hinduism, with about 6% claiming Buddhism. We'll look at Buddhism next week. Buddhism really is an outgrowth of the concepts of Hinduism. So those religions, though different in a lot of forms, are very similar to each other. But really, Hinduism, Islam, and Christianity make up really the three major world religions. The hard part for me this morning in explaining Hinduism to you is that whereas Christianity and Islam both basically have a book and a key figure, Jesus Christ and Muhammad, Hinduism is very different than that. And so you're going to have to really think this morning and work with me. I forgot to tell the first service that these slides that you're going to see, which explain all this, are available to you. If you'll email my assistant, she can send them out to you. Last week's slides were not. Those were copywritten. Norman Geisler, you can go on his website, you can buy them from him, which I did, but you can't just have mine. But this week you can have mine, because these are all mine. And so if you ask for them, you can have them, which is going to help some of you, because you're going to be trying to write all this down, and there's no possible way you're going to get it all down. So we're going to hurry through this morning. Let me recommend a book to you. It's called The Compact Guide to World Religions. This is an incredibly helpful book. In just a few pages, it'll give you kind of an overview of the basic world religion and then kind of a Christian explanation of how you respond to that. And I believe our evangelism team in the back is selling these. You can pick one up on your way out the door. Great handbook. I would also like to draw your attention to a pamphlet that's in your Eternal Perspectives that says Defenders Network, ready to give an answer. We have a team of people who are well-versed in philosophy, Christianity, and world religions who would be happy not only to answer your questions, but would be happy to interact with other people's questions. And so we believe that a faith should be defensible, it should be reasonable, it should be well thought through. Not everybody has the time to do the research, but the people who are committed to this ministry would love to have the opportunity to interact with you and help you as you witness to people who are coming from other philosophical or religious backgrounds. Let's talk about Hinduism. And really, Hinduism, the word, is very interesting, the origin, the meaning and the origin of the word. Hinduism really is the Persian word for Indian. And as the Muslim conquerors, about 1200, pushed their way into India and began to take over portions of India, they tried to come up with a name that would differentiate their religion from the religion of the people that they were conquering. And so they called them Hindus, which is simply the Persian word for Indian, which speaks an awful lot about what this religion is all about. In fact, one of the early presidents, well, before I say that, let me just say that Hinduism is very confusing because it has no founder, no prophet, no structure, and no creed. Well, you say, well, how are you going to talk about it? Well, believe me, there's a lot to talk about. But one of the presidents of India once made the comment that Hinduism is more a culture than it is a creed. In other words, rather than having a set of beliefs or a theology, it's more a part of a way of life. And Hinduism is so deeply tied with the land of India, with the Ganges River, with all of the customs. When you listen to their music, it's all religious in nature. Everything that they do has some kind of religious connection, that it's a lot about the way a group of people live. It tells their history. It records all of their beliefs. And all that is amalgamated into this religion. So, when we look at this religion, where did it come from? Well, somewhere between 1000 and 1500 BC, The Vedas, which are the basic writings of Hinduism, were being written down. During this time, there was a priestly class called the Brahmin, who would predominantly give the ritual for the people to connect the people with their gods. They were a group of people that were polytheistic. They believed in myriads of gods, and the Brahmin were the priests. And as the priestly rituals became more complicated, the Brahmin began to actually write them down, along with their hymns and their forms of worship. And all of that compiled together forms the basic text of the Hindu religion. That's called the Vedas. Well, the Brahmin became more and more powerful, because basically whoever controls access to gods, to get the favors of gods, usually are the people that also, in a culture, can come up with the most money, because they get people to pay them in order to perform the rituals to get people to get what they want. And as they began to rise in power and moved up to the top of the heap socioeconomically, the people began to struggle with that, and they began to revolt, and there was a period of purging when a new form of literature was written to try to interpret the Vedas, and that was the Upanishads, which is kind of the New Testament of Hinduism, written somewhere between 900 and 800, all the way down to about 300 B.C., and that kind of forms the basic texts of this faith. Now, within those texts, if you're looking for a uniform creed, it's really hard to find one. For example, in some places in the Vedas, you will read the concept that there are many gods, and there are many gods to worship. We in the West call this polytheism, the worship of many gods. And if you ever look at a Hindu temple, you'll see these tall temples, and you'll see all these figures lining the temple all the way to the top. We'll give you a close-up of them. These figures, animals and people, represent various gods. In fact, some have estimated that there are over 330 million different gods in the whole of Hindu worship. So the Vedas say that there are many, many gods to be worshipped. The Vedas also, in a different place, say that there are many gods, but there are certain gods that are worshipped by certain groups. Now, in the West, we would call this henotheism. That is the recognition that there are many gods, but there's really a god for each particular group to worship. In addition to that, in the Vedas, it also says in some places that there's only one single god. In the West, we would call this monotheism. There are other places in the Vedas that express doubt as to whether the gods really exist and whether people could really know them. In the West, we would call this agnosticism. In addition to that, in the Vedas, it also talks about a form of reality that encompasses everything. In the West, we would call this monism. And there's a personal view of monism, and there's an impersonal view of monism. You say, which one of these do the Hindus believe? Well, it depends on which group you go to, but the Vedas have different types. I mean, they're different contradictory things within the system, which oftentimes makes it hard for a Westerner that wants to think in a logical sequence to grasp it, because it says a lot of different things, written at a lot of different times, in a lot of different ways. Having said all that, there is this concept of monism is the primary thing that has emerged out of Hindu study over the years. And it's basically that there is a reality that transcends this physical world in which we live. And you've seen people that practice Hinduism having the dot between the eyes, and that represents the third eye, or the eye that can see that which is not here. The eye that can see the true reality, which is not able to be comprehended by the physical five senses. That brings us to the beliefs of Hinduism. And as I share these beliefs with you, these are the beliefs that almost all Hindus of all different kinds of orientations would embrace. As I said before, this is not a logical system. And so we have lots and lots of people that would say, well, that's not exactly what I believe. In fact, within Hinduism, there are three major schools that are considered unorthodox, and there are six major schools that are considered orthodox that have slightly different beliefs within the system. And so you may run into somebody that holds to a slightly different belief, but the ones I'm going to give you kind of transcend them all. They fit into all of them. And the first belief is the impersonal nature of Brahman. The impersonal nature of Brahman. Now, Brahman is the God concept in Hinduism, but it's very different than what you might think of in Christianity. Brahman refers to transcendent absolute reality. Transcendent absolute reality. It is a cosmic force containing all things, a unifying natural force that makes all things what they are. It is without qualities. When I say without qualities, that means it has no attributes or characteristics. It's not love. It's not justice. It's not mercy. It's not physical. It's not fast. It has no qualities. It doesn't change in any way, shape, or form, and it's the stability, the force, that is the real reality, that which really, truly exists. What they say is that everything that changes, everything that's in a state of flux, which creates joy and sorrow, which creates pain and suffering and also pleasure, all of that is not reality because it changes. Brahman never changes. That is truly stable and truly real. And therefore, Brahman is peace. Brahman is bliss. Brahman is everything wonderful because it's perfect. It never changes. There's no ups and downs in it. So that's kind of the highest value, and it's impersonal. It doesn't have a name, doesn't have a face. It's not a person. It's absolute reality. The second major belief of the Hindu religion is the Brahman-Atman unity. The Brahman-Atman unity. Now, what is Atman? According to the Hindus, Atman is the universal self. It is the absolute knower. It is the source of cosmic experience uniting all consciousness. So, whereas Brahman is absolute reality, Atman is absolute consciousness. It's the ability to know. And these two are connected to each other. In fact, they're one and the same. So, as an individual, Atman, your consciousness, is in you. It's also Brahman, and so you are Brahman, and Brahman is you. In other words, you are divine, and divinity is you. So you are God, and God is you, or that God concept, that absolute reality, you're a piece of that. But here's where the problem comes in. The problem is you don't know that. You don't know that. And that's the concept, the problem of Maya. It's illusion, the problem of Maya. I know it's hard for a Westerner to grasp this, but just think with me, because it is a fairly systematic system that you can work through if you think about it. The problem of Maya. Maya is the illusory condition of everyday experience. Belief that Maya has permanence prevents us from experiencing unity with Brahman and Atman. In other words, everything that changes in the world in which we live, everything that changes is not real. Because the only thing that's real is that which never changes. That's Brahman. So everything that changes, history, experience, feelings, pain, pleasure, that's all an illusion. That does not really exist. That is you being confined to a personal sense of consciousness, which is a barrier or keeps you from merging with Atman, which is really Brahman, which really makes you part of the unchanging nature of the universe, of the world, of everything that is and that exists. And so the world in which we live is an illusion, and we are stuck in this because that's where we are. We think, we feel, we experience, and we believe that those things really are happening, that that's a real thing. And so how do you get liberated from this? How do you move forward? The liberation comes from moksha. And moksha is the concept of release. Moksha is release from the human condition that prevents union with Brahman and Atman. And it happens when you experience enlightenment. In other words, when you get to a point where you finally understand that what you experience, what you feel, what you taste, touch, smell, what you're seeing around you is not really real. At some point along the way, when you reach a consciousness where you connect with the conscious reality of the universe, at that point in time, you merge with it, you become one with it, and you enter into a state of perfect peace and perfect bliss. And so the goal of life is moksha, enlightenment, to throw off this world, to throw off the things that hold us back, and to move into a state of enlightenment. It's the way we think and the way we are. The problem of humanity is a problem of ignorance. We have come from Brahman. We are part of Brahman, but we don't know it. We need to be released back to it. But while we're in this state of incorrect thinking, there is a law that affects all of us, and that's the law of karma. Karma is the law of cause and effect. That is, whatever I do will result in something else that will affect me in the future. So what I do today will affect me somewhere in the future. That's the law of karma. It's the ongoing influence of past actions on the future. Now, sometimes we think in terms of karma being something of justice. It's about justice. In other words, if I mistreat somebody, then my karma is going to be that I'm going to be mistreated, and that's what this is about. But that's not what karma is about. Karma is not about people getting even or getting payback or getting what they deserve. Karma is about taking us through a process where we come to understand. It's a spiritual journey where we come to understand that the physical world and our personal experience does not really exist. And the law of karma serves there as a cyclical pattern of giving us the opposite experience. In other words, if you have pleasure in this life because you took advantage of someone, then you'll have pain in the next life in order for you to come to grips with the fact that pleasure or pain, neither one of those are real. And to break you from thinking that pleasure is true, that it's life, that it's real. And so the law of karma takes you through the cause and effect cycle. And what do you do when you have things that you did, said, or felt in this life that are not resolved? Well, you've got to go through another life. And that brings us to the cycle of samsara, reincarnation. Samsara, the cycle of birth, death, and rebirth that accounts for our physical existence. So as long as we're bound and not enlightened to move into Brahman, as long as we're in that state, we're going to be reborn, we're going to be reborn, we're going to be reborn, we're going to be subject to the laws of karma, the law of karma, until we reach this enlightenment and we're moksha, we're released. So let me show you how this works. I'll give you a little chart here to show you how this works. Existence, according to the Hindu mind, existence could be, depending on which school of Hinduism you're in, could be in the form of human, it could be in the form of plant, animal, mineral. In other words, in this life, depending on what school you embrace, in this life you could be a human. In the next life you might be reincarnated as an animal or a plant or a mineral. Or you may be a mineral and you may be reincarnated into a higher form. And there's lots and lots of writing that kind of differentiates how all that happens and how all that works. And there are different schools of thought that embrace how all that works. But basically, you exist, and when you die, at the end of your life, when you die, the soul is evaluated. The soul leaves the physical body, and the soul is evaluated to see if you have any karmic debt or not. If you paid all your karmic debt, that is, you've been liberated from the illusion of this life, then what happens to you at that point in time is that you move forward into a merger. You move forward into a merger. And that merger is either in an impersonal way, being absorbed into God, absorbed into Brahman, where you become part connected with reality and you no longer exist as an individual. Or some Hindus believe in a more personal connection, and that would be you move into a communion with God, and into a communion with Brahman, where there's some kind of a connection there. If you have karmic debt that is not paid, then you are reincarnated into a new existence, and you start the cycle over again. And what most Hindus embrace is that this cycle continues on and on and on until you reach a point of enlightenment. For some people, that may take 100 lifetimes or 1,000 lifetimes or 1,000,000 lifetimes. But you keep going through this process until finally you get there. Finally, you reach a state of enlightenment, and everybody's on that path. Everybody's moving toward enlightenment. Some are going to take forever to get there. Some are going to take a less period of time. But everybody's moving along that path. And so, the goal is to renounce this world as an illusion. To come to grips with the fact that suffering is not real, not be bound by it. That pleasure is not real, so I should not be bound by it. That possessions are not real, that I should not be bound by them. That history is not real, and the events of history do not really affect anything, I should not be bound by it. That somehow I need to disconnect from everything that the senses can touch, feel, see, and experience, and somehow merge my conscious mind. Atman, with Brahman and then experience perfect peace and bliss. When you say, you know, that's where it really gets messy. How do you do that? I mean, how do you live in this world and pay your karmic debt and go through experiencing your existence? And at the same time, how do you do that? And at the same time, denounce it, walk away from it, move away. How do you do that? Well, that's where the schools of Hindu thought go in lots and lots of different directions. And there are lots and lots of different books and writings that try to describe what do you do with your life now, how do you live your life, and how do you move through it. Basically, they summarize into three different yogas or three different disciplines. And those three different yogas are the various paths that you can take to move to moksha. The first one is knowledge. Through learning, philosophical thinking, and meditation, you can come to a place where you're enlightened and you throw off the physical world in which you live. The second way is through action. Practice and ritual, doing your duty, following ritualistic experiences, through that you can break with this world and you can be moksha. The third is through devotion to a god. It's through adoring a god, following a god, striving after a god, and letting that god lead you or help you or get you there. And there are many, many different types of gods or different kind of manifestations of Brahman that you can latch onto and you can follow. And so that brings us to probably the most clear concept that Westerners have embraced from Hinduism. And that concept, which is espoused in Hinduism, is that all roads lead to enlightenment. All roads lead to enlightenment. You ask the question, well, which one should I take? Should I take the way of knowledge, the way of action, the way of devotion? And the answer to that question is whatever works for you. Whatever's best for you, however it fits you, because ultimately you are Brahman, and ultimately, through the cycles of reincarnation, you're going to get there eventually. And so whatever path you choose to take doesn't matter, because anything that leads you to enlightenment will get you there. Now, some have come away from that, and some even modern Hindus have come away from that, saying that that basically means that Christianity is a path, that Islam is a path, that any path you take is fine because you're eventually going to get there. That's not really what Hinduism, in its earlier conception, believed. It believed that the path is embracing the Hindu concept. And so you could be a Christian if you wanted to, and maybe after several lifetimes, the laws of karma would bring you to a place where you would reject Christianity, because the God of Christianity is not the same kind of God that Brahman is in Hinduism. It's completely different. The God of Christianity is personal and transcendent. The God of Hinduism is not. The God of Hinduism is impersonal, and the God of Hinduism is absolute in the sense of that's what all reality is. So they're different. But over time, eventually, even as a Christian, that would come out of you through the process of reincarnation, and eventually you're going to merge. And so in many ways, much of Hinduism promotes a tolerance that's not promoted by some of the other religions of the world. What I would suggest to you is that the path to enlightenment has taken many, many forms in Hinduism over the years. And trying not to be overtly critical, but honest about Hinduism, I want to point out just three things that I think raises the question of whether this is a valid system of thinking, or whether this is a valid spiritual system. The first one is that if life doesn't matter, it doesn't really exist, and that physical pain, physical experience, is not really real, then the rituals often take on some very, very strange and unusual behavior. For example, probably one of the most well-known festivals is the festival called Thaipusam, which has been outlawed in India because of the violence that's been created surrounding it. But I want you to see a little bit of some of the ritual that has been spawned by this religion. We'll look at 3 minutes of this. And the guy who's speaking on here, Ravi Zacharias, is an Indian. He was raised in India. And when he speaks, he's got a little bit of an accent. So the one word you may have trouble with is when he uses the word devotee. He's talking about the follower of this religion, And let's watch it. It's the festival of Taipusam.
This is an annual festival called Taipusam. It is held during the full moon of the month of what they call Thai. And the key idea here is devotees come, most of them, just to offer homage to their Lord Muruga. Muruga was the second son of Lord Shiva. The older son was Ganesh, known familiarly as the elephant god. But this annual pilgrimage that they all make to the Lord Muruga temple is a very spectacular occasion. Some key devotees will wear what they call a kavadi, with many, many spears that hook into their body and knives that go through their mouths, and for many of them even through their tongues. The whole goal is somehow to make a very serious vow to Lord Muruga in the hope that he will fulfill one of their dreams, one of their ambitions, and that somehow by this process of self-immolation, that dream and vow will be fulfilled by their Lord. It's an incredible sight. I don't think you would ever believe it until you have seen it. Yesterday, thousands, tens of thousands lined the streets as coconuts were smashed onto the road. It was to cleanse the path for the chariot on which the golden statue of Lord Muruga was being taken. It moves from one temple over to another. And as this golden statue then is placed at the Lord Muruga temple, the devotees come to container of pure milk, pour that milk over his statue, and literally rivers of milk will be flowing by the side. This is a very deep-seated belief for many of them. The pain that is inflicted upon them is somehow intended to make some kind of atonement and commitment in the hopes that God will, their God, will provide the satisfaction that they are seeking. You can see dazed looks in the eyes of the devotees who are going to bear the kavadi. And as they start walking away, his assistant just pulls back on the hook so that the skin is stretched. You can see some of them wincing in pain when it is first put in. But they have this done just after a time of prayer with their God. This kind of a visual glimpse is not afforded to many, and as discomforting as it is, it puts in reality, I think, the love of Christ and the compassion he felt for the masses. As one convert from one religion into Christianity once said to me, the more I see of others, the more beautiful Jesus Christ looks to me. I think you will find that out.
For those of you who might hang out down on the drag, that may not look too strange to you. You know, the body piercing thing is in and so forth. But the whole concept there is that by inflicting physical pain, I deny the reality of pain because pain doesn't really exist. And that mentality is part of one of the ways that people liberate themselves from this way of thinking. And you know, I show that to you because I think most of the time when we say, you know, all religions are equal and they all promote good and there's good in all of them, you know, a lot of times we don't really even know what various religions embrace, what they do, what they practice. Which brings me to my second critique. As I study the system, what I find is that there's a very close merger between the caste system of India and Hinduism. For those of you who don't understand what the caste system is in India, for years and years and years in India, there were basically four castes. Three of them were the upper caste, those were the more privileged. Then there was the servant caste. And then there was a caste below that that didn't even qualify for a caste. That was the untouchables. And those folks in that category were made popular or probably brought to light, you know, basically through the Sisters of Charity and Mother Teresa working in India. But in the Hindu writings, it's very clear that if you try to transcend your caste, if you're in a servant role, in a servant caste, and you try to step out of that and not do your duty within your caste, it will speak badly to your karma It will be breaking a natural law, and you will come back in a much more difficult setting. And so since the pain that you might experience from slavery or from servitude or from hunger or from the hardship of your life is really an illusion anyway, it doesn't really exist anyway, in fact, it's part of the road to enlightenment for you, then stay where you are. Now, in India today, the government has outlawed the caste system. And I would suggest to you that there have been many people who have taken other religions like Christianity and tried to manipulate it to cause people to be in poverty or be in slavery, or they've misused it. But if you actually read the text of the Bible does not tell you to do that. In fact, the Bible talks against that. However, when you read the writings of the Vedas, and you read the writings that are associated with Hinduism, it's actually, the caste system is pointed out, prescribed, and explained as something that is part of the religion. If we were to say today, by the way, the religion is developed by the Brahmin, who are the priests who are writing these things, developing the religion, and they're also at the top, financially, of the caste system. If we were to say today, you know, that we were going to develop a religion which would make people stay in their various places, including poverty, and the people who were writing the religion were the ones who were going to end up at the top of the heap, that would be a little questionable, wouldn't it? But that is literally in the writings. And so it raises the issue that we have to wrestle with. Was this system actually developed to create an atmosphere or an environment where the people that were at the top of the system benefited and the people that were at the bottom of the system were religiously required to stay in their place and serve? No, there would be a lot of people who would deny that, and I would challenge you to go back and read it. Go back and read the writings that teach this approach. Very interesting. You know, most of the writings are not written in a logical, systematic format. They're told in the form of stories that have been passed down for years and years and years. One of the stories that is really telling is a story in one of the most famous books about a prince named Aruna who was basically about to go into battle, and the opposing force in the battle was his uncle. And as he was about to go into battle, take his armies in to fight against his uncle, he was having some serious reservations. And so he asked his charioteer, Krishna, who is one of the incarnations of one of their gods, he asked his charioteer to drive him to the battle so he could see what was going to happen. When they got to the front of the battle, he looked and he saw all of his friends, he saw his brothers, he saw his uncle on the other side, he saw his cousins on the other side. He thought to himself, I do not want to see all this bloodshed. I don't want all the people that are close to me to die. Wouldn't it be better, since this doesn't mean anything anyway, wouldn't it be better just to do nothing? And Krishna says to him, now this is one of their gods, Krishna says to him, that's true, you could do nothing, that's fine. He says, but you need to understand that in the course of this battle, though if someone dies, that's irrelevant because they're going to be reincarnated anyway. So it doesn't matter if people die in this battle, fighting. In addition to that, since you're of the kingly ruling caste, it is your duty to fight the battle because that's what kings do. And so therefore, you fight the battle understanding that it doesn't ultimately mean anything because it's an illusion, and that all the people who die in the battle, they're going to be reincarnated anyway, so it doesn't even matter. Now, I don't know about you, but that's really hard for me to put my arms around. God is saying if you kill your uncle, it's not that big of a deal in this battle. God is saying that it doesn't really matter if people suffer and die because this is all an illusion anyway. And George Harrison is singing, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. And I wonder, is that what he believed? Did he support that kind of thinking? Stay in your caste, do your duty in that caste. If people die, it's not that big of a deal. If people suffer, it's not that big of a deal because it doesn't matter anyway. This is all an illusion. It doesn't really matter. The third criticism that I have is that the system itself cannot be validated because the system does not believe in anything that is validatable. They don't really believe in history, so you can't go back in history to validate proof that God did this at this time or God did this at this time. The system is not validatable because it doesn't construct itself on the basis of logic. In fact, what's interesting is in the writings they say that the people who claim that they understand are probably the furthest from reality, from truth, and the people who say that they know the least are probably the closest to enlightenment. And so to even try to validate the system in itself is moving you further away from really coming to enlightenment. There's no validation. In addition to that, you can't validate it from reality, from anything you touch, taste, feel, or smell. You can't validate it in that way because all that is an illusion. And so, in essence, what you're left up to is to live your life based on a system or a philosophy with a view that when you die, you're going to be reincarnated, you live your life on the basis of it again, and eventually, when you are Atman, connected with Brahman, then you will know that what you believed was really true. But up until that point, you'll never know, because even trying to validate it in and of itself is the wrong way to approach it. You just have to embrace it and go with it. And in the process of that, of rejecting everything and going with it, that's when you're going to find truth. That's when you're going to find enlightenment. Now compare that to Christianity. I'm going to fly through this really quickly, just laying the two side by side. In Hinduism, God is impersonal. In Christianity, God is personal. In Hinduism, humanity is continuous in the sense of being extended from the being of Brahman, from the being of God. In Christianity, humanity is discontinuous in the sense of being separated from the being of God and continuous in the sense of being made in the image of God. So though we're created in the image of God, we're not God. Humanity's problem in Hinduism is ignorance. Just don't know. We don't understand. In Christianity, it's moral rebellion. We've rebelled against God. The means for salvation in Hinduism is striving to detach oneself from the separated ego and seeking to be aware of the one unity with the divine thought through self-effort. Through my effort, I'm going to be united with the unity. In Christianity, the means of salvation is repenting of sin and trusting in the completed substitutionary work of Jesus Christ. He paid the debt. The outcome of Hinduism is that you merge into the oneness and the individual disappears. In other words, your separate identity no longer exists. You become part of the oneness. In Christianity, it is eternal fellowship with God. The person is fulfilled in a loving relationship with God. In other words, you keep your selfhood, you keep your personhood, God keeps His personhood, and now you have a relationship with one another, and that relationship is blissful. That's heaven. Okay? How about karma compared with sin? Concept of karma. There are a couple similarities. Both involve moral issues. Secondly, both affirm the existence of a cause and effect relationship between our actions and the results that they produce in our lives. So in sin, if you do something wrong, there's going to be negative consequences. In karma, if you don't follow the right path, there's going to be something negative in consequences. However, they have key differences. Karma does not affect one's relationship with Brahman, which is the essence of existence within all things. So whether one's karma is good or whether it's bad makes no difference to the fact that we are unconditionally extended from the oneness of Brahman. In Christianity, however, sin does affect our relationship with God in that we become alienated from Him. And one of the attributes of God is His moral holiness, and our sin reveals an attitude of rebellion against His moral authority. In the law of karma, which makes morality like a law of nature, it does not allow for the possibility of forgiveness. In other words, you do it and you pay for it, and you do it and you pay for it. You cannot be forgiven. Its consequences are inevitable and inescapable. Someone says, well, that happened to me because that was my karma. There was nothing I could do about it. I can't change it. It's something I did. I'm going to live with it. In Christianity, in sin, because God is personal and because persons can forgive, God can forgive our sins. Moreover, He has done so through Jesus Christ. Well, when you're talking about actually interacting with Hindus, sharing your faith with Hindus, what are some principles or some things that you can do to help them understand where you're coming from? Let me give you a few of them. The first one is offer Jesus forgiveness. Offer Jesus forgiveness. The law of karma allows no forgiveness. If people are trapped in a cycle of pain and suffering that could go on for years and years and years, and every time you mess up, if you don't embrace enlightenment, if you don't understand it, you do it again, and you do it again, and you do it again. It's kind of like a dark version of the movie Groundhog Day. I mean, you start over again. Now, as you move toward enlightenment, it may seem like it's getting better, but better is only an illusion, so it doesn't really matter if it's better or worse in this life. Jesus Christ, on the other hand, says something entirely different. Jesus, in one of the key verses to talking with Hindus, comes in Matthew 11, 28 through 30, where Jesus makes the statement, "Come unto me, all." In other words, there's not various paths. Jesus says, "Come unto me, all you who labor and are burdened, are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." He says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly of heart, and my burden is light, and I will give you rest." You'll find rest for your souls. Connecting with God, finding rest, finding peace, finding satisfaction. Jesus says, "Come and learn from me. Take my yoke upon you. My burden is light." Why is my burden light? The reason why my burden is light, Jesus Christ says, is because I bore the weight of your sin. And in me, you don't have to think in terms of play it again, live it over, pay for it again. Oh, I messed up today. That's going to come back and get me. You don't have to do that. With Jesus Christ, He forgives. Jesus Christ took the suffering, the punishment for our sin. Offer forgiveness in Jesus Christ. Number two, keep God's personhood in mind. Keep in mind that in the Hindu concept, the idea of Brahman being a person is not part of their concept. Point to the fact that God is a person, someone that you can have a relationship with, not a human per se, but God has an essence. He's an existence. He's not impersonal. He has attributes. He has characteristics. He can be known. Third is ask questions and listen. Hinduism is entirely complicated. And if you really want to understand what a person thinks or believes, you have to talk to them. Find out what they think. Find out what they believe. It's not a matter of you trying to cram what you think on them. Ask them questions. And what you're going to find out is that many Hindus don't really understand their own religion. And many of them, it's more of a cultural thing. So listen to what they think. And at that point in time, then you can begin to dialogue about truth. Number four, have a humble spirit. Have a humble spirit. Most Hindus view people from the West as being spiritually bankrupt. They view themselves as putting more time and energy and effort into their own consciousness, their own spiritual endeavors, their own rituals. And they view people from the West as primarily after money and promotion and progress. And to come on to a Hindu and to be real aggressive and real bold and real arrogant, that just reinforces the stereotype of Americans. They think they know it all, and guess what? In the Hindu system, those people who think they know it all probably are the furthest away. So be humble in the way that you talk with people.